Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good Friday afternoon. It's the show on 91.5. I'm Steve Goldstein, along with Todd Zwillick today. In Valley traffic, an accident I-10 eastbound at Chandler Boulevard. And Valley weather for this weekend, it should be sunny and dry. We're expecting highs on Saturday and Sunday to be around 107 to 109 or so, and clear skies in the overnight hours with lows in the lower to mid-80s. Currently, relative humidity is at 11%. It's mostly sunny and 106 degrees at KJZZ. This has been a very difficult week for communities across the country, and what we're about to hear is an indication of that.
They shot him?
In Jesus' name.
Amen. He just shot his arm off. We got pulled over on Larpiner.
I told him not to reach for it. I told him to get his hand out.
Call me brother if you need a hand. We all need somebody to lead.
What do we want?
Justice.
What do we want?
Now.
And what do we want?
Justice.
Now, after the events of this week, Americans across our country are feeling a sense of helplessness, of uncertainty, and of fear. And these feelings are understandable and they are justified. But the answer must not be violence. The answer is never violence. Rather, the answer, our answer, all our answer, must be action.
Attorney General Loretta Lynch on the violence in America over the last 72 hours. The killing of two African-American men by police, one in Minnesota and one in Louisiana. The protests of those killings and others unraveled by sniper fire in Dallas as police officers are gunned down. The already impossibly complex national conversation about police and guns and race is now even more convoluted. The Dallas Police Department does not have a reputation for the use of excessive force or police brutality. In fact, it has become something of a national role model for community policing. Dallas Police Chief David O'Neill Brown said the motivations of the shooter, named Micah Xavier Johnson, age 25, were clear.
The suspect said he was upset about Black Lives Matter. He said he was upset about the recent police shootings. The suspect said he was upset at white people. The suspect stated he wanted to kill white people, especially white officers. The suspect stated we will eventually find the IEDs. The suspect stated he was not affiliated with any groups, and he stated that he did this alone.
So part of the problem Americans have to unravel is how police patrol a nation where guns are legal and part of the culture, and where the Americans they stop or pull over own 300 million firearms. It also raises the question for many Americans, primarily people of color, of how they stay safe, even when exercising their right to own a gun. Nick Selby is a detective in the Dallas area in Texas. He's also author of the book In Context, Understanding Police Killings of Unarmed Civilians. Nick Selby, your thoughts now on the officers killed in Dallas.
It was obviously shocking and obviously very, very sad for the families of the officers who were killed last night. I have to say, filled with pride watching the Dallas Police Department handle this situation so professionally, watching those officers run towards the danger, handling the situation, and most of all being as transparent and open as they were throughout the night, giving out information, which is really exactly what we need our police to be doing, giving out more data earlier, and that's exactly what the Dallas Police Department did today.
One of the real difficulties as the country tries to digest all this, it seems to me, is that there's this difficult conversation about police and civilians. There's a difficult conversation about race and about guns that we've been having all these many months and years. And now it's a conversation inevitably that's also about the killing of cops. And that's way more complicated.
I think it is. And I think that the dynamic that we have right now in the country is unfortunately one of, there's a lot of mistrust. And I think that a lot of people are speaking past one another. I think that both law enforcement officers, law enforcement administrators, government officials, activists, and just citizens are taking refuge in a position and speaking their position, but not actually hearing the other. And I think that to get past this, we're going to have to start having some fundamental trust that both sides want to make things better and listening more to one another.
Nick Selby, one of the issues that we did want to talk to you about is how police operate in a country that is awash with guns. The reality is that police are going to confront suspects all the time with guns in this country, both legal and illegal, because there are 300 million guns in America. We saw the case especially of Philando Castile in Minnesota, who, according to his fiance, had a legal weapon with a permit and told the officer. It raises the question of how police approach people when they know they have a gun and deal with that situation. What can you say about those many, many times that must happen?
Yeah, and without speculating on that, because we actually don't have the video, I'll tell you what I do, and I think it's instructive. Whenever I get pulled over, I will turn the engine off. I'll roll down my windows. If it's at night, I turn on my dome light, and I put my hands on the top of the steering wheel. The reason I do this is I want the officer to see that I'm making an effort to make him feel safe, and it also removes the need for me to move my hand quickly or reach something to get something. It's all right there. So if you are at that point carrying a concealed weapon, or if you have a gun in the car, you know, those of us who carry concealed, we've already made a lot of adjustments in our lifestyle. We buy special clothes. We buy special holsters. This should not be any different. Keep your driver's license, your weapon permit, your registration, keep it all in the same place as far from that gun as possible. And then as the officer approaches and he tells you why you've been stopped, hand him your papers. And then once you have the papers in his hands, you say, "Officer, please be advised for your safety. I'm a concealed weapon permit holder. I do have a handgun in the car. It's located in a holster on my right hip. What would you like me to do?" And when you do that, you've given him the control. Sometimes they'll actually tell you to get out of the car. They might want to disarm you. A lot of times they'll give you sort of the equivalent of, "Hey, don't show me yours and I won't show you mine."
I want to play you a piece of sound from a journalist at the Washington Post who was on the show yesterday. We were talking about how the Washington Post has tracked the 509 Americans killed by police so far this year. For a little bit of context, this is Stephen Rich of the Washington Post.
The numbers really haven't changed on a lot of fronts. The majority of victims are still white people, but black people are killed at a rate of about 2.5 times that of white people.
A rate of about 2.5 times of white people. That's the Washington Post data, Nick Selby. And that raises the question of this conversation that you and I are having about what to do when a police officer approaches and you have a gun. I think a lot of African-American people hear this conversation and say, that does not always work for us.
Sure. And the strategy I just mentioned is I would believe, and my colleagues would believe, is the absolute safest strategy. I do want to point out that the Washington Post, while in those numbers, what the Washington Post itself found last year was that fully 90% of the people who were shot by police and killed by police were in the process of a deadly attack at the time that they were shot. This is not just sort of arbitrary killings. And the 2.5 times is really a population-controlled number that is disputed by a lot of academics. I will not say that the fear or trepidation that African-American drivers have is unreal. I believe that that's very real. But in terms of crunching those statistics, I think that the more important thing is when you as a driver, whether you are white, black, Hispanic, doesn't matter. When you as a driver go out of your way to slow things down and give the officer the control of the situation, they will almost always respond in kind, and they will respond reasonably.
There is some reason to believe, however, and I go back to Philando Castile in Minnesota, that he did inform that police officer, maybe not in such a procedural way that you're describing, Detective Selby, but he did a lot of things right and still wound up with a deadly gunshot wound.
And I literally cannot argue that, because I just don't know what happened in that case. And I think that, you know, what we have on that case is it's an interesting case of dueling narratives on the same video. We're going to have to watch and see how that plays out.
Let's talk about the person that maybe you're not as confident about, however, somebody who has a gun in their pocket. How dangerous is that gun if it doesn't come out? If that person says, I've got a gun, or if you see part of a gun or you suspect they have one in their pocket, but they haven't brandished it?
That's a terrific question. It's actually at the crux of it all, right? In our book, we talked about killings by police of unarmed civilians, and many people believe that because a civilian is unarmed, it means that he's not dangerous. We had two people who were unarmed who actually had already murdered someone by the time the police arrived last year. And similarly, you know, when I'm going to the store and I have a gun that's in my holster and I'm squeezing the tomatoes, I might be armed, but I'm certainly not dangerous. It really does come down to the context of the situation. If someone has an illegal gun, even, and they're not reaching for it, they're not doing anything particularly with it, that's not something that gives me an immediate concern. Where I start to get concerned is where people start to give us combat indicators. They start to give us indicators that they're getting angry. They're ready to start using physical force or deadly force. That's when the danger level really comes up, and that's, I think, something that officers are generally very, very good at detecting. And generally good at detecting it correctly.
Nick Selby is a police detective in the Dallas area. He's the author of In Context, Understanding Police Killings of Unarmed Civilians, and he was talking with Todd Zwillick at our partners at The Takeaway. The mood across the country is somber, and people are reacting to last night's deadly shooting of five police officers in Dallas, including across the valley. In Tempe, Lily Duran, who's a police spokesperson, says the department has issued a new safety protocol following yesterday's attack.
We are allowing officers to ride a two-man unit if they want to. We're going to continue to monitor as things unfold, and we're going to adjust accordingly.
Prayer vigils are also taking place in several U.S. cities, including an event by civil rights leaders and community activists in downtown Phoenix tonight. All of this comes on the heels of two other police-involved shootings of two African-American men. Former Tempe Councilmember Corey Woods has been thinking about race relations for most of his life.
When I first got my driver's license at the age of 16, you know, many African Americans, you know, talk about their parents or someone in their family giving them the talk. And I did get that talk. My father, you know, had conversations with me, and my mother had conversations with me about, you know, how to behave if I was ever, you know, happened to be stopped for any reason.
He says there are challenges for many African Americans when it comes to equal treatment, and it's important to have an open and honest dialogue about that.
There's been a feeling by African Americans that the concerns are kind of brushed off, and that it's, you know, you're just being paranoid, you're just sort of making a mountain out of a molehill. You know, those issues are serious. I mean, the fact of the matter is, you know, in life, we talk about this all the time, you know, perception is reality.
Although Woods is skeptical that racism in America will ever be eradicated, he remains optimistic about forging solutions.
But I think to ever say that, you know, at some point in 10, 15, 20, 30, or even 50 or 100 years, that there won't be instances of racism or sexism or homophobia, I mean, those will always take place. But all we can hope for is that we're willing to confront these challenges openly and honestly, have real conversations, make policy changes that really will get at the root of a lot of these core issues, and continue to try to move forward as a collective people.
Former Tempe Councilman Corey Woods. As we mentioned, a vigil and rally are scheduled for downtown Phoenix tonight to mark the killings of two African-American men this week, one in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and the other in St. Paul, Minnesota. With me to talk about the events of this week, including the sniper shootings of police officers in Dallas, is Phoenix community organizer Catherine McKinney. Catherine, are there certain policy shifts that you'd like to see law enforcement make, or is this a larger societal challenge that goes beyond law enforcement that needs to be addressed?
I think one of the things that we really need to address is the training of the officers. We are not criminals, and they are taught to look at us as such. We need a big-time police reform. Another thing that needs to be changed, I believe, is that officers, though they represent the law, they are not above the law. They should be treated just like anyone else when they kill somebody. I don't believe it's appropriate for anyone to kill anybody. And I believe if there were more stringent rules towards that part of policing, to know that they can be held accountable to the same rules for acting out of code of ethics, then maybe they'll think twice about how to de-escalate and handle a situation.
How important do you think it is at this stage for law enforcement in this area, in other areas of the country, and communities of color to have an honest dialogue? And can there be an honest dialogue? What would that sound like?
Why couldn't we have an honest dialogue? Everyone is entitled to their opinion about things, and that means everyone has a voice. Everyone has something to say if they want to have an opinion, and we should be able to discuss it as human beings.
Do you think that can happen?
I think it can happen. It happens now. You know, we don't talk about that as much as we talk about the discourse, but there's a lot of good things going on too in the community amongst institutions and people of color. But there's still a lot of things that we have to address. This is being the main thing as far as institutionalism of racism is the policing upon our community.
There's a rally scheduled for tonight. How important is a rally like this? And even more important, how vital is it that it is a peaceful rally tonight?
Rallies throughout history have always been important. That starts the catalyst for the change. People uniting only shows the government that there are people concerned. So our goal is to let them know that we are concerned about this. This is affecting many of our families, and it has been going on for generations.
Even if it's just incremental, can a successful rally tonight actually lead to more of that dialogue you're saying is already out there, but can that make it feel like people are able to come to the table more? Basically what I'm saying is can a good rally tonight lead to anything positive in the future?
It can. It should open the door for us to have that honest, open dialogue. Our leaders are being challenged right now with one of the greatest things in history, and that is to show unification behind things that we believe need addressing. And this is not only a call to show the government that, but this is a call to the nation. We have to have solutions, and we have solutions, but we have to be at the table.
Phoenix community organizer Catherine McKinney. The city of Phoenix is scheduled to have a news conference on this topic later this hour. They say the lights are bright in Phoenix, but those lights are in the process of changing to LEDs. A public comment period ended on June 30th that gave residents the chance to weigh in on whether a 4,000 Kelvin bulb or a 2,700 Kelvin bulb would illuminate better and be cost and energy effective. The respondents split almost down the middle, with 50% preferring the lower Kelvin and 45% in favor of the higher. In a moment, we'll hear from a member of the International Dark Skies Association. I'm joined first by Mark Hartman, Chief Sustainability Officer for the City of Phoenix. And Mark, how much of an improvement will the new lights bring to Phoenix?
Oh, it's absolutely. The current lights are, they're kind of multi-directional. They can shine actually on people's houses. They can shine in people's yards and on the street. They kind of light up everything around them. But also, they have lots of dark gaps in between the lights. Well, the new LED technology actually is focused directly downward, so it lights only the sidewalk and the street. So actually, and many people notice it gets darker around the side areas as well. So much better quality lit streets, and you don't get that zebra striping that you see, on many of our streets.
How much does this fit into quality of life if you're in Phoenix when it's dark?
I think from a city perspective, I think having that well-lit and safe neighborhoods, I think, is a priority. There certainly is a consideration that some cities, particularly those with observatories, would want to have where they say, look, we want to, after a certain hour, just turn all street lights off. And it has a great advantage to make it a lot darker and better visibility for an observatory. But from a safety perspective, both for cars and pedestrians or those out on the street, it's actually much better to have. Generally, most of the major cities say, you know what, from the safety perspective, this is what cities are for. We really need to provide that, you know, nighttime safety perspective that streetlights can provide.
So, Mark, where do we go from here as far as what you weigh, as far as what the recommendation should be? How much do you weigh what the public has said? How much do you weigh the costs? And how much do you weigh the effectiveness of the lights?
It's really a sort of a balanced solution. You kind of look at all of them, and there could be a great kind of a much more of a win-win where you can go with a light that's, you know, certainly has a, you know, least amount of blue and at the same time is very cost effective. And actually, so you can actually, we'll have an opportunity to save money and actually have a light that works very well. Currently, the ones in range, you know, the 4,000 Kelvin light is kind of more like a moonlight. It's sort of representative. It's the same number of Kelvin of typical moonlight would be. And then the 3,000 Kelvin is even more yellow than that. You know, from a public's point of view, I think they're kind of split on this thing. Actually, both are nice. And actually, if you don't see them side by side, but see them individually, you might not know which is one or the other from looking at it.
Mark Hartman is Chief Sustainability Officer for the City of Phoenix. One group that's been paying close attention to Phoenix's decision is the International Dark Skies Association. John Barentine is its program manager. John, what are the issues related to choosing one kind of bulb over another?
There are an increasing number of stories that you're seeing in the media about instances where cities have put in very cool white lighting that emits relatively a lot of blue light. And that has resulted in some resident dissatisfaction with the outcomes. People have complained about the lighting having a sterile kind of hospital quality to it, or one comment I read in a news story was, the mothership has landed. It's a very different kind of light in terms of color than the kind of golden peach-colored high-pressure sodium lighting that we've seen in most cities for about the past 35 or 40 years.
Can there be a slow progression to this, though? Does the City of Phoenix have to be in a particular hurry based on what you know?
I don't think that the city has to be in a particular hurry, although the consequence of the world turning to solid-state lighting is that it's gradually letting go of earlier technologies like the type of lighting that you'll see on the city streets in Phoenix now. And if it holds on to that for a whole lot longer, eventually it will become increasingly difficult to find replacement parts and find light bulbs and that sort of thing. And my organization certainly is not opposed to LED lighting. We're not trying to prevent these conversions from happening. But the idea of slowing it down a bit and doing one's homework and trying to get all the information is certainly something that's very advisable if, as the city has pointed out, you're making a change that you expect will last for a couple of decades.
Now that we're in the sense of the sixth largest city, what are some of the built-in challenges of that? Certainly Phoenix can never be like Flagstaff or Sedona at this point because it's already so lit up, it seems, that the dark sky concept in some areas of Phoenix, frankly, seems lost. When it comes to doing something like the changing of these lights to LED, how important a decision do you think this is?
We're not going to necessarily come back to a point where you can see the Milky Way from downtown Phoenix at night. But at the same time, I don't think that the right thing to do is to simply accept that living in a heavily light-polluted environment, which I would describe most of Phoenix with that term, is a natural consequence of living in a city, and that we can never do anything to improve that situation, because I think that we very much can do that. And at some level, lighting our cities has turned into an arms race, where one part of the town gets a little bit brighter and it raises the ambient light level in that area, and then another part of town kind of has to catch up with that for fear that it doesn't want to be seen as being too dark, particularly because of the psychological association that people make between darkness and insecurity or a problem with public safety. But the result is that cities have been getting brighter at a rate that exceeds the rate of population growth.
John Barentine is the program manager for the International Dark Skies Association. John, thanks.
Thank you, Steve. It's been a pleasure.
Mexico is making it harder to import used cars from the U.S. There are hundreds of auto importers along the border whose livelihoods depend on moving America's four-wheeled rejects into Mexico. But Mexican customs agents have abruptly reduced their hours and the number of cars they let through. As Monica Ortiz Uribe reports from KJZZ's Fronteras desk, the move has created a lot of anger across the border.
A sorry parade of banged up cars idle bumper to bumper near a remote border crossing outside El Paso. There's hundreds of them lined up farther than the eye can see. Some have smashed windshields and missing headlights, others dented hoods held shut by bungee cords. All are waiting to cross into Mexico.
Tengo ya 5 días. Queriendo importar aquella...
I've been waiting 5 days to import these two cars, says Gerardo Roman. He's part of an entire economic sector along the border dedicated to the revival and resale of clunkers from the U.S. In the last decade, Mexico received more than 7 million used cars from north of the border. This backlog of cars at ports of entry in California and Texas has sparked chaos. Last month in Ciudad Juarez, angry import salesmen blocked commercial traffic coming into Mexico for several hours. At a border crossing south of San Diego, the Tijuana Chamber of Commerce counted as many as 4,000 cars waiting to be imported. Customs is strangling commerce at the border for arbitrary reasons, says Eloisa Talavera, a congresswoman from Baja California. Mexico's customs agency didn't respond to multiple requests for an interview. But earlier this week, the head of the agency told a major Mexican newspaper that they were cracking down on illegal imports, cars whose values are deliberately underestimated to evade taxes, or cars with fake emissions reports. But the reduced hours and the fewer imports at the border hurts those who do business legally. Importers suspect customs is caving into pressure from Mexico's domestic auto manufacturing industry. New car sales lag behind used car sales in Mexico. These two industries must learn to coexist, says Talavera. While new car sales have remained relatively stagnant in the last decade, the automotive industry isn't suffering for it. On the contrary, Mexico is Latin America's number one auto exporter. Every major brand like Ford, Nissan, and soon BMW have a factory there. In the last 5 years, Mexico exported 14 million cars, mostly to the U.S. Eduardo Solis is president of Mexico's Auto Manufacturers Association. He says the only pressure they're putting on Mexican authorities is to go after illegal car imports. Too much trash from the U.S. ends up on our streets, Solis says. If a vehicle isn't fit to be driven in the U.S., he says, it shouldn't be allowed on Mexico's streets. At a neighborhood body shop in Juarez, a worker repaints an imported Chevy Silverado cherry red. Other cars in the shop still have registration stickers from Minnesota, New Jersey, and Massachusetts. One even has a bumper sticker for ex-presidential candidate Ben Carson. Juan Flores is a second-generation salesman who's been selling U.S. imports for 20 years. He says they make car ownership a reality for low-wage Mexicans who don't have access to credit. But at the moment, business is bad. Like other import salesmen, Flores is paid for the cars in U.S. dollars. And right now, the Mexican peso is weak. We're trying to make miracles, he says. His used car shop is among dozens more that line both sides of a major street in Juarez. Last week, a delegation of auto importers like him met with officials in Mexico City to try and resolve the situation at the border. In the coming months, they hope to help legislators craft new laws that will better regulate the flow of used cars coming from the U.S. Monica Ortiz Uribe, KJZZ News, Ciudad Juarez.
In KJZZ News at 2:37, the Navajo Nation is creating its own Amber Alert plan to respond to kidnappings like the one that resulted in a young girl's death in May. It would be the first of its kind in the country. From KJZZ's Fronteras desk in Flagstaff, Laura Morales reports.
Police say Ashlyn Mike and her brother were lured into a van on May 2nd and driven to a remote area in northwestern New Mexico. The 11-year-old girl was sexually assaulted and killed. The boy escaped and ran to the nearest road, where he was picked up by a passing driver. An Amber Alert did not go out until 2:30 the following morning, several hours after the boy told police what happened. Navajo President Russell Begay called on a task force to implement an Amber Alert system and set a 60-day deadline. The tribe wants a system independent of the three states that make up the sprawling reservation. For now, the Navajo Nation is partnering with states to ensure alerts get out quickly. The tribe is down almost a third of its police force. Several officer shootings in recent years have many police handing in their badges. Laurel Morales, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
As more Americans were being prescribed painkillers and related meds, addiction grew and an epidemic has emerged. Earlier this week, the White House announced plans to provide $1.1 billion to fight opioid abuse, including prescriptions and heroin. Arizona will receive $21 million under the plan. Governor Doug Ducey's spokesman Daniel Scarpinato says a couple of pieces of Arizona legislation show the state's commitment to fixing the problem. One creates a prescription drug database for doctors, and the other allows pharmacists to dispense naloxone,
which has been proven to be a bridge for people who have either overdosed or who are addicted, a bridge for them to recover.
To get more insight on what Arizona can do with the additional funding, I'm joined by Andrew Lefevre, Executive Director of the Arizona Criminal Justice Commission. About 5 years ago, five counties in Arizona were part of an initiative to reduce prescription medication abuse. Andrew, what was the focus?
That was called the Arizona Prescription Drug Misuse and Abuse Initiative. It was a data-driven, multidisciplinary approach that utilized community-based organizations to really be the change agents in their community, and they did that in five pilot counties. It was Yavapai, Mojave, Pinell, Graham, and Greenlee counties as kind of projects or counties where they could see if this would work, and they focused on five key strategies. It was reducing the illicit acquisition and diversion of prescription medications in the first place. We also looked at, you know, how do we promote responsible prescribing practices from doctors, really taking a look at doctors across the spectrum, grouping them together. So, you know, pain management doctors obviously are going to prescribe more pain medicine than non-doctors, but giving them an ability to look to see how they stack up against their colleagues. So if you have a doctor that's prescribing way more prescription medication than other doctors, why is that? And then working with them to come up with best practices to say, if somebody comes in and really needs pain management for 5 days, then give them a 5-day prescription. Don't give them a 30-day prescription. So again, how do we reduce the amount of medication that's out there? You know, we looked at how do we train law enforcement to recognize prescription drug abuse and for what it is and the problem that we see.
So you have certain methods you think will work, and the extra funding should help make that even better.
Most definitely. We want to make sure that we focus on all aspects of the problem, you know, education and prevention on the front end, law enforcement activities that can prevent and dismantle drug rings and the access to the medication and the drugs in the middle, and then treatment on the back end. Because, you know, what we've seen is, you know, 1 in 15 folks that take non-prescription pain relievers in a way that isn't prescribed from them get hooked on what we call prescription pain medications is going to try heroin within 10 years. So it definitely, folks that get addicted to prescription pain medication oftentimes transition to heroin because it's cheaper than the pain medication is. It's the same type of high, but, you know, they're not starting on heroin. You know, the dirty connotation that goes along with it, they think, oh, it's just pills and there's nothing wrong with that. And, you know, that becomes part of that education process, is letting folks know that there is a danger to those medications, that, you know, you there's a purpose and a place for them, but, you know, you really need to be careful when you move on from that.
Andrew, can you put it into context for us? How big a problem this is in Arizona compared to some other states? Are we near the top?
Arizona's ranked about 12th or between 12th and 15th nationally for the amount of stuff. And just to kind of give you an idea what that means. So opioid overdose causes about 46 deaths per day in the United States in general. In hospital charges for non-fatal poisoning related inpatient hospitalizations in Arizona was more than $213 million in 2013. So there is clearly an over-prescription and over-utilization of pain medication.
Andrew Lefevre is Executive Director of the Arizona Criminal Justice Commission. Andrew, thank you.
My pleasure, Steve. Thank you.
Nearly 1 in 5 pregnancies ends in miscarriage in this country. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say another 25,000 babies are stillborn each year. But even though this kind of loss is incredibly common, many parents who've experienced it say they felt like they were going through it alone. KJZZ's Stina Sieg introduces us to a new program that's trying to change the way we experience the loss of a baby.
That's Lydia Joy Zeal's heartbeat, captured a few months ago on her dad's cell phone. It was strong the whole time she was in the womb.
And the heartbeat's not supposed to be that strong.
Not for babies like Lydia, says her dad, Stephen Zeal. Long before Lydia was due, he and his wife Melissa found out their baby had a rare genetic disorder called trisomy 18, which can lead to physical and mental abnormalities. Melissa says the vast majority of babies who have it die within days or hours of their birth, or even in utero.
That was probably the moment where it felt like the world kind of probably shattered on us.
And then they met Cherokee Isles.
I call myself a paradigm shifter.
Isles has been trying to change how our culture deals with the loss of babies for nearly 35 years. She's written books, trained hospital staff, and most recently co-founded a program called Lost Doulas International and Baby Loss Advisors. Doulas are traditional caregivers who typically help with live births, while lost doulas are specifically trained to deal with the death of a baby. Both these doulas and advisors walk parents through the experience of miscarriage, stillbirth, or sudden infant death syndrome.
It is important to grieve and mourn these little ones, to recognize that our lives are different.
Isles began this work after her son Brennan was stillborn in the early 1980s. That was back in the dark ages, as she calls it, a time when dead babies were often whisked away by nurses, maybe not even shown to their parents. Isles says she was lucky because she briefly held Brennan. But other than that, she says she and her husband did everything wrong.
No pictures, no mementos of any kind. We literally left with empty arms. I have nothing that he touched.
So much deep regret. Isles knew then she wanted to save other parents from it, parents like Stephen and Melissa Zeal. As their baby Lydia's due date got closer, they spoke with Isles many times over the phone and even in person, since they all live within miles of one another in Tucson. Isles helped them cherish the pregnancy, Melissa says, and also plan for the birth, even if the outcome was the worst. As Melissa puts it,
being able to say hello and goodbye at the same time.
So when Melissa's water broke, she and Stephen say they both felt prepared. Almost a day later, Lydia was delivered in silence.
He almost felt like you're holding your breath, waiting to figure out what was going on, what was happening.
I asked the nurse to check for a heartbeat multiple times because I thought, well, maybe it just took a minute.
That was not the case. Lydia was stillborn. But she was still their baby, so with Cherokee Isles' help, they set about to make all the memories of her they could. They got footprints and handprints, took professional photographs, introduced her to their families. Melissa says they spent hours and hours with Lydia, trying, like Isles had mentioned, to memorize every little part of her.
You know, look at her eyes, see if she has any birthmarks, who does she look most like, and we all agree she looked more like Steve. So, and definitely had his...
She looked pretty good.
Maybe why they're able to laugh now is because they both say they have no regrets.
There can be blessings, there can be peace, there can be joy in the mix of difficult circumstances. And those are things to, no matter how hard they are, they're also things to be able to celebrate.
Melissa says having someone like Isles by their side made that celebration possible. So far, Isles has helped train about 50 other loss advisors and doulas across the country. Stina Sieg, KJZZ News, reporting from Tucson.
The Arizona Diamondbacks may have been the big winner in Major League Baseball's offseason. They signed free agent Zach Greinke, arguably the best starting pitcher available. They also traded for young pitcher Shelby Miller, considered to be rapidly on the rise for an excellent career. To get him, the team sent two top prospects and a starting outfielder to Atlanta. That move has been dreadful so far, as Miller has had one of the worst seasons of any starting pitcher in baseball. So after the offseason hype, the Diamondbacks find themselves tied for last place in the National League West. And earlier this week, a game against San Diego had the worst attendance for a home game in Diamondbacks history. How did they get here and how did they climb out? Arizona Republic columnist Paula Bovin joins me to talk about that. Paula, was the offseason hype overdone?
I don't think it was overdone, because when you're paying, you know, $206.5 million for a pitcher, that says you really believe in him and that says you really have high expectations. And, hey, I was excited, too. I was happy to see for fans in town that the team was trying to build a winner. But you know, baseball, I think the biggest difference is baseball is not like, say, the NBA, where you can add a LeBron James and it changes everything. You have to have a lot of other things work in addition to a big signing, and that's players staying healthy, and that's, you know, having a lot of depth at different positions, and a lot of those things hurt the Diamondbacks.
Now, did you, like a lot of experts and just a lot of fans, actually think this team would be in a much different spot, even if they weren't some sort of favorite? I think most people would have thought they would at least be in contention for a playoff spot at this point.
Oh, no question. You know, and I know even like Vegas kind of came out with their odds, and you can say what they want you want about Vegas, but they tend to be pretty good sort of predictors of things. And they had them, you know, maybe finish second in the division. And that's kind of where I thought they would be. Whenever you have really good starting pitching, it can overshadow a lot of other problems. So absolutely, I thought they would be in contention. I did not think I would be writing about this, and especially about that awful home record.
In your column earlier this week in The Republic, one of the things you talked about was this highly accomplished management team. Tony La Russa is someone who has won World Series as a manager. Dave Stewart, very successful player. And even Derek Hall, who is kind of a marketing whiz, one would think that when these three people put their heads together, things would work out better. How much of this do you put on that management team?
You know, Steve, it's interesting, and I will be 100% truthful. I probably sat an hour before I wrote that paragraph because it was really hard for me to put it on guys who had these really impeccable reputations. Certainly La Russa, you know, the tag, the genius, because of what he has done in the past and the way he's managed teams, and he's always such an innovator. And Stewart, this great accomplished career as a pitcher, and then went on into, you know, he was an agent, he worked in management, and Derek Hall's reputation here in town has been downright and understandably so impeccable. I mean, the guy is regularly, that organization has been regarded as one that, you know, is a great place to work for. He has done so much for the community, raising money. People like to be part of that Diamondbacks organization. So to have these guys at the core of the problems was a hard sentence and paragraph for me to write. But I think at the end of the day, you have to look, if it was just one thing, then maybe you blame a pitcher or something else. But when there seems to be these collection of problems, you have to think that maybe some of these guys were in, you know, arenas that they shouldn't have been. I mean, La Russa had this accomplished career, but never as sort of the COO. So I think these guys, too, have to shoulder some of the blame.
Earlier this week, that game against the Padres, the Diamondbacks had the lowest attendance in the history of the organization at Chase Field, Bank One Ballpark, whatever we want to call it. You know, is that a really scary sign?
It's definitely a tough one. I mean, you know, that day was sort of the perfect storm of bad situations. The day after a holiday, people out of town, it was a really bad opponent. Well, not a lot of reason for people to go to the ballpark. But the other reality of this town is there's a lot of opportunity and competition for the entertainment dollar. There's a lot of people in town who are fans of other teams. If you start winning, all that other stuff goes out the window, and they will come.
Paula Bovin is a sports columnist for the Arizona Republic and AZ Central. Paula, thank you.
My pleasure, Steve.
In an update of KJZZ News at 2:51, a vigil and rally are scheduled for 8 o'clock tonight in downtown Phoenix to mark the killings of two African-American men by police this week in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and St. Paul, Minnesota. The rally is being led by the Reverend Jarrett Maupin. Among others, Mayor Greg Stanton has asked organizers to delay the event for another day, but Maupin says it's going forward.
I spoke to Chief Yonner, and I think we found some common ground on how to move forward. He certainly disagreed with the protest, but then again, we have decided a long time ago to agree to disagree.
Maupin says they'll march from City Hall to Phoenix Police Station to the attorney's office and through Roosevelt neighborhood. He says he's asked people not to bring firearms or weapons. And just a few minutes ago, Mayor Stanton says communication is the key.
There is a painful but very critical national discussion that is happening regarding the relationship between police and the communities that they serve. That's a conversation we're having right here in Phoenix. Not just today, not just after Ferguson, but for many years now.
That's Phoenix Mayor Greg Stanton. Also, Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson says there appears to have been just one gunman in the Dallas shootings. There have been exceptions over the years, but it wasn't until recently that Phoenix has found itself mentioned among the best restaurant cities. There are dramatically diverse choices for the kind of cuisine you'd like to eat and the amount of money you'd like to spend. And one significant member of downtown has gotten into that mix. It's the Phoenix Convention Center, which named a new executive chef in the spring, Masoon Shirmohammadi, who has had an extensive and varied career in the business of cooking. He originally came to the U.S. from Iran as a teenager and was planning to go to medical school. I met him recently at the convention center in his innovation kitchen. And yes, he was wearing his official chef hat. We started by talking about whether he's able to use his creative flair at a convention center where the groups of attendees can grow into the thousands.
Well, my training really is a French classical cuisine. And over the years, you know, you have to evolve. As an executive chef, you really dabble in all kinds of cuisine. What I loved about this place is really the Southwest part of it. So the menus I'm creating now, they are Southwest with the French influences. And it's really, that's what I love about this job. I can really add my own touches, recreate, you know, the old dishes or just create new dishes from my past experiences. So I would say right now it's more of a Southwest with French influences.
What are some foods? What are some dishes you can tell us about?
Well, a couple of the last dishes that I created, it was a Sonoran rub salmon with the red pepper coulis, and it had the avocado mousse on there, and it had a tomato and green chili chutney. So if you see that dish, it's really, you're talking about three or four different type of cuisine and the complexity, but the beauty thing about it is everything's come together and it, everything works well. And really based on the experiences I have, you know, I have a very keen understanding of the products and the flavor profiles and how it might come together. I think about those first, and then of course I'll make them once or twice if they work well, and if it doesn't, I'll make the necessary changes, yeah.
How much input do you get initially, and does it change depending on what type of group of conventioneers may be here? Is there a certain group that you might have to lean toward this sort of dish, or another might be perhaps a little bit more adventurous?
No, absolutely. You know, this room here is our tasting kitchen, so we do this for the large groups. They come here, I do prepare the menu for them based on the demographic, and really they have a 4-course, 5-course meal here, and we go ahead and make every dish. We go change the profile if it's necessary. Absolutely, we take all those into account, their nutritional aspect of it as well, and of course we have a lot of guests that they're concerned about gluten. So just because of that, 95 to 100% of our entrees are gluten-free as well. And we do make vegetarian dishes, but I'll make those now. They're not only vegetarian, but also they are vegan as well.
So let's talk numbers a little bit. So in the course of a year, mm-hmm. how many conventions do you expect to cook for? And considering how many people are there, how many meals? I mean, when you're talking about, I mean, some of us will look at a recipe, mm-hmm. think, oh, okay, serves 4 people. You're not serving 4 people. You're serving a lot more than that. So how do you figure that out?
No, we do have recipe files that we have created that scales up and down recipes for us, and we'll do that ourselves. But, you know, last year we served 2.6 million or visitors we had here at the convention center. This convention center became the living room and dining room of City of Phoenix. So I think what we do here is greatly important. Not only are we representing, you know, the City of Phoenix, but also the culinary aspect of it as well.
Now, Phoenix is a city that's really gaining in reputation for being a culinary place. Restaurant reputation really going up. What do you think of that, and how important is it that the Phoenix Convention Center, what you're doing, kind of matches that?
No, I think that's extremely important. Again, when you have travelers coming not only from all over the country, but all over the world, these people are well-traveled, and they understand good food. And when they come here at the, you know, the Phoenix Convention Center, they might only visit us and maybe one or two neighborhood restaurants. And really what they experience here is what they will take away from here, as this is Phoenix. So we would take that very seriously. And that's why we're concentrating a little bit more of a Southwest cuisine, to make sure we give our guests a little bit of a taste of what Phoenix is when you visit us here.
I wonder if you could walk me around a little bit. And since it's radio, maybe describe a little bit more about the room we're in and how you use it.
Well, this room here is our innovation kitchen. And really, this is my sandbox. You know, this is what I get to do things, and I will feel very comfortable here. And you can be creative. You know, sometimes we close the door here and just try to create some new dishes. So it's a wonderful room, and I believe it cost a lot of money to create this room.
I was really struck by the phrase your sandbox. So can you take us a little bit more into that? When you're in here, how much experimenting can you do when it's just you sort of thinking about things?
Well, really a lot. And especially, you know, when it comes to, let's say, changing our new menus or come up with the menu ideas. You know, I write stuff down and you know, order a whole bunch of different type of ingredients. I have a general idea where I want to go, but I don't really know what I'm going to end up. And this is really, I rely on my experience. And of course, some research I do, just like any other chef. Or if I go out to a restaurant and I look at the menu and then I tried a few of the dishes that I really like, I try to come here and emulate those dishes. Or, you know, borrow some of those ingredients and create my own.
What happens when you're tired, you're feeling just like trying something? You ever just kick back and make a grilled cheese at home?
Oh, absolutely. You know, grilled cheese. And I just fire up the backyard grill and yeah, just throw some flank steak or steak on there. Or really, I love burgers. Now it's taco. Now I'm in Phoenix, so it's taco time.
That's the recently named executive chef for the Phoenix Convention Center, Masoon Shirmohammadi. We met in his innovation kitchen downtown. That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.